As we continue Joshua chapter 13 today, the central feature to keep in mind is that the Lord has ordered Joshua to divide and distribute the land of Canaan among the tribes of Israel. Now, this dividing comes at a somewhat unexpected time, because even with the resounding military victories of Joshua and Israel over the southern and then the northern coalition armies of the kings of Canaan, virtually the entire coastline is still in enemy hands. So the job of conquering Canaan is not finished, and there's much left to be done. So before we reread a portion of Joshua 13, I think the God principle I would like to reiterate as the one that Joshua was learning and that as believers we need to constantly keep in mind is that perfect circumstances are never necessary for us to be obedient, nor are they an indication to go ahead and move forward in God's work. Therefore, it is rare that we will ever fully complete a task to the level it ought to be. Yet by no means is that ever an excuse to hesitate or procrastinate. We do what we can with what we have, when we can, and then we just rely on the Lord. Canaan was not fully taken. It was not fully at peace. But it was sufficiently under control so as to allow allotment of land to the tribes. There was no legitimate reason to wait any longer to do this. So open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 13. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, we're going to be starting on page 256, because we're going to start at verse 8. With the half-tribe of Manasseh, the Reubenites and the Gadites received their inheritance, which Moses had given them beyond the Jordan eastward, just as Moses, the servant of God, had given them, from the Aroer on the edge of the Arnon Valley to the city in the middle of the valley, all the plateau between Medvah and Divon, all the cities of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon, to the border with all the people of Ammon, and Gilead, the territory of the Geshuri, and the Maakati, and all of Mount Hermon, and all of Bashan as far as Salkah, that is, all the kingdom of Og in Bashan, who ruled in Ashtaroth and Edrei. Og was one of those remaining from the Rephaim, who Moses defeated and expelled. However, the people of Israel expelled neither the Geshurites nor the Maakites, with the consequence that Geshur and Maakat have lived among Israel to this day. Only to the tribe of Levi did Moses give no inheritance, because the offerings made by fire for Adonai, the God of Israel, are its inheritance, as Adonai had said to Moses. Moses gave land to the tribe of the descendants of Reuben by clans, and their territory included Aroer on the edge of the Arnon Valley, the city in the middle of the valley, all the plateau near Medvah, Heshbon and its villages on the plateau, Divon, Bamot Baal, Beit Baal Mon, Yahatz, Kedemot, Mefat, Kirtiot Yayim, Sivma, Tzeret Shachar at the top of the valley, Beit Peor, the slopes of Pisgah, and Beit Yeshmot, all the cities of the plain, or of the plateau rather, all the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who ruled in Heshbon. Moses defeated him with the chiefs of Midian, along with Evi, Rechem, and Zur, Hur and Reva, the princes of Sihon who lived in the land. Along with the others, the people of Israel killed with the sword, so they also struck down Bilam, the son of Bor, who practiced divination. The Jordan formed the border for the descendants of Reuben. This was the inheritance of the descendants of Reuben by clans, with its cities and villages. Moses gave land to the tribe of Gad, to the descendants of Gad by clans. Their territory included Yaser, all the cities of Gilead, half the land of the people of Ammon as far as Aroer fronting Rabbah, that is from Heshbon to Ramoth Mitzpah and Betonim, and from Machanaim to the border of Lidvir, while in the valley it included Beit Haram, Beit Nimrah, Sukkot, and Tzafon, in other words, the rest of the kingdom of Sihon, king of Heshbon, with the Jordan to the far end of Lake Kinneret as its border, their territory extended eastward. This is the inheritance of the descendants of Gad by clans, with its cities and villages. Moses gave an inheritance to the half-tribe of Manasseh. It was for the half-tribe of the descendants of Manasseh by clans. Their territory included Machanaim and all of Bashan, that is, all the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, all the villages of Yair and Bashan, 60 cities, half of Gilead, and Ashtaroth and Edrei, the cities of the kingdom of Og and Bashan. All this was for the descendants of Machir, the son of Manasseh, or rather, for half of the descendants of Machir by clans. These are the inheritances which Moses distributed in the plains of Moab, beyond the Jordan and Jericho eastward. But to the tribe of Levi, Moses gave no inheritance. Adonai, the God of Israel, is their inheritance, as he told them. Now, this is another one of those places in the Bible where it would be much better if the chapter markers were just left out. Starting at about chapter 11 on through chapter 19, it is just one continuous story of how and when the land of Canaan was divided up and given to each Israelite tribe. Verses 8 through 13 speak of the land on the other side of the Jordan, the east side, in the area that scholars dubbed the Transjordan. The point of these verses is to demonstrate that Joshua wasn't any more of a failure than Moses was when it came to conquering the land fully. The general boundaries of the so-called 2.5 tribes of Israel are called out in these passages, making it abundantly clear that it was Moses who was in charge at the time. It was he who gave this land to Reuben, Gad, and half of the clans who make up the tribe of Manasseh. And that two foreign nations consisting of people called the Geshurites and the Maachites were not driven out of the 2.5 tribes' territorial area. Instead, they were left to live nearby and in some cases even to dwell among Israel. So even Moses, God's own mediator, and a man so highly venerated by his people, he did not succeed in his task. Therefore, no one should hold Joshua to a higher standard than Moses, nor should Joshua be seen as less than an excellent leader simply because he didn't drive out all the Canaanites from the entire west side of the Jordan. The other point of these passages is to show that Moses divided the territory in the Transjordan before it was completely conquered. So there's no reason that Joshua shouldn't do the same thing on the opposite side of the Jordan River. Well, then in verse 14, the Levites are mentioned. This is because they are not counted among the 2.5 tribes on the eastern bank of the Jordan, or the 9.5 tribes that would occupy the western side. In fact, soon we're going to encounter a rather lengthy explanation of just why Levites were left out of the count of Israelite tribes. There is a good and a very practical reason why this review of the makeup of the Israelite nation and this very special status of the Levites just suddenly pops up at this point in Joshua. And at some point, you know, every generation begins to ponder their current state of affairs. And we ask questions about certain things, why they are as they are. Why is it this way in our culture and in our society? Why does one group, tribe, clan, family, why does one group seem to have an inherent advantage or disadvantage when compared to the other ones? Isn't there something we ought to do about things to make everything more fair? Is it time maybe to make a change? Is it time to set aside our inherited traditions of the past for a whole new future? And when left to our own devices, we often make changes that never quite pan out as we envision them. usually it's near to impossible to reverse the effects and go back to how it used to be. The Lord God wanted to make it very clear it was He who made the decision on the treatment of the Levites to deny them land. It was He who made these decisions and the divvying up of the land of Canaan among the tribes and among the clans of Israel, and then the tribal makeup of Israel and more. None of this is to be tampered with. Verse 14 says the Levites would receive no land as their inheritance, and this was God's firm position on the subject. But instead of land, Levi would receive the offerings made by fire to the Lord God. Now, this has to be stated in a roundabout way in earlier books of Torah, but now it's a little bit more clear as to what exactly God's intention was concerning what it was the Levites were to receive. We have to recollect our understanding of holy property, though, in order to get a picture of just what all this means. Offerings made to God at the tabernacle, later on at the temple, were given the general name, name not used very often in the Bible, Ishishe. And this referred specifically to burnt offerings, but also generally to all sacrificial offerings devoted to the Lord by whatever means. Now, to the Hebrews, it meant whatever had been set apart as holy property for God. Therefore, that could include vow offerings, and especially as pertained to this moment in Israelite history, it could include spoils of holy war. In other words, the Levites were entitled to the same holy property that the other Israelite tribes were prohibited from under pain of death. Therefore, except for the dwelling places of the Canaanite people that were destroyed by Joshua's army, and except for the Canaanite people themselves that were killed, generally speaking, everything else that was designated as holy property, taken as God's portion from the spoils of war, that was to go to the Levites for their use. This system was ordered in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 10:9, we read, "This is why Levi has no share or inheritance from his brothers. Adonai is his inheritance, as Adonai your God had said to him." We'll talk about a little bit more about that later on in our lesson. Now, up to now, the general area of the Transjordan was described as being given to the 2.5 tribes of Israel. But with verse 15, we get a lot more exacting boundaries associated with each of those 2.5 tribes. The country between the Arnon River to the south and the Jabbok River to the north of it was divided between Reuben and Gad. And it was bounded on the south by Moab and on the east by Ammon. And the southernmost district was given to Reuben. It extended from the Arnon River to the point of connection to the inlet of the Jordan River into the Dead Sea. Now, Gad's territory followed along the eastern bank of the Jordan River. In other words, that would have been its western boundary. Then eastward from there, it reached as far north as the Sea of Kinnereth. It also goes by the name of the Gennesaret. We know it better as the Sea of Galilee. Now, north of Gad's territory lies the region set apart for the tribe of Manasseh, or better, half of the tribe of Manasseh. Now, I know this gets a little confusing. It needn't be. Okay. Manasseh was a very large tribe. And when Moses was still leading Israel, and they were yet to cross over the Jordan into the Promised Land, and so they were still operating in the Transjordan, many of these clans that made up the tribe of Manasseh liked what they saw. They didn't want to go any further. But an approximately equal amount of other clans of Manasseh, they wanted to continue on. This was a very serious complication. It easily could have meant intertribal warfare and blood feud killings within that tribe of Manasseh, unless a compromise could be reached. The solution was that those clans of Manasseh who wished to stay in the Transjordan, they would be allowed to do so. Those who wanted to move on would also be allowed to do so. Each would keep their tribal affiliation and their tribal identity. Part of Manasseh didn't become a new and separate tribe. Yet, as it was inevitable, eventually there was tremendous power struggles and calls for success, for a secession, and even some serious battles between East Manasseh and West Manasseh. Now, a good map shows that the two Manasseh territories weren't even contiguous. So the table was set for some real ongoing political problems within the tribe of Manasseh. Thus, we get this designation of the half tribe of Manasseh, of which obviously there were two. And a good question to ask right about now might be why we get all this stuff about 2.5 tribes getting their land over in the Transjordan, since this seems to be but repeating everything we heard back in Deuteronomy about this same event that happened several years earlier. I mean, it reads as though this distribution of land to the east of the Jordan was some kind of a current event. What is happening is that while Moses designated that land as set apart for the 2.5 tribes, there was a very substantial caveat placed in that. The deal was those 2.5 tribes had to supply troops to fight alongside the remaining 9.5 tribes as they went about conquering the land of Canaan on the west side of the Jordan. Further, Joshua would decide when the soldiers of Reuben, Gad, and some of the clans of Manasseh had fulfilled their duty to fight alongside their brethren. This was that time. The major battles for the southern and northern regions of Canaan had been fought and won, and the 2.5 tribes did everything they said they'd do. Therefore, Joshua, under the direction of God, is ready to declare that the eastern lands are now officially given to Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. They have no further duty to the 9.5 tribes who have now moved into the promised land. Let's move on to Joshua chapter 14. Open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 14, page 257, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. These are the inheritances which the people of Israel took in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar, the priest, meaning high priest, Joshua, the son of Nun, and the heads of the ancestral clans of the tribes of the people of Israel distributed to them by lot for them to inherit, as Adonai ordered through Moses for the 9 tribes and the half tribe. Moses had already given the inheritances to the 2 tribes and the half tribe beyond the Jordan. To the Levites, he gave no inheritance among them. The descendants of Joseph constituted 2 tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, and they gave no portion of the land to the Levites except cities to live in, with the open land surrounding them for their livestock and crops. As Adonai had ordered Moses, so the people of Israel did. They divided the land. Now the descendants of Judah approached Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, The Kenizzite said to him, "You know what Adonai told Moses, the man of God, about me and you in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of Adonai, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to reconnoiter the land, and I brought back to him an honest report. My brothers who went up with me discouraged the people, but I followed Adonai, my God, completely. On that day, Moses swore, 'Surely the land where your foot has been, will be the inheritance for you and your descendants forever, because you have followed Adonai my God completely. Now look, Adonai has kept me alive these 45 years, as he said he would. From the time Adonai said this to Moses when Israel was going through the desert, today I'm 85 years old. But I am as strong today as on the day Moses sent me. I'm as strong now as I was then, whether for war or simply for going here and there. Therefore, give me this hill, the one Adonai spoke about on that day. For on that day you heard how the Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps Adonai will be with me, and I'll drive them away, as Adonai said. Joshua blessed him, and he gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, as his inheritance. So Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, as it is to this day, because he followed Adonai, the God of Israel, completely. Hebron was formerly called Kiriat Arba. This Arba was the greatest man among the Anakim. Then the land had rest from war. Now the first words of the first verse show us that the subject is switching from settling over in the Transjordan to now occupying the land of Canaan. And by definition, the main character also switches from Moses, he's the one who led the assault on the eastern territory, to Joshua, who led the assault on the western territory, Canaan. Now suddenly, after not hearing anything about him for some time, the name of Eleazar, son of Aaron, currently the high priest of Israel, all of a sudden it reappears. And this reappearance is in the context of the event of distributing the land of Canaan among the 9.5 tribes who have yet to receive their own territories. Now we see that this allotment of land was a joint effort of Israelite leadership with Joshua, who's the secular leader of Israel, Eleazar, the spiritual leader of Israel, and the 10 tribal princes, one for each of the 10 tribes that would be the recipients of the land. Now, I say 10 princes, tribal leaders, even though we speak of 9.5 tribes, because we have 9 full tribes and about a half of the clans of the 10th tribe, Manasseh, receiving land in the west. While we can speak of a half a tribe, you can't have half a prince. Thus, there were 10 princes present for this ceremony. The method for land distribution was by means of lots. Now, don't think that the presence of the high priest meant that he was needed in order for the lots to be drawn. This could have been done without him. But the nature of dividing the land was divine, so it was appropriate that the high priest, Eleazar, would at least have some role. Now, truth be known, nobody really knows what the procedure for using lots actually amounted to, although there are traditions that suggest how it might have gone. It was that there were 2 jars that contained polished stones used as the lots that were randomly selected. The other thing we should take note of is that there were 2 separate occasions when we find the lots used to divide the land. The first was when Moses directed it back in Moab, and then there's this one with Joshua leading the way. So why were lots employed 2 times to deal with the same land transaction? Now, though it's not stated directly, it becomes pretty clear that the first choosing of the lots with Moses dealt with relative juxtaposition, that is, the general locations of each tribal territory in the land, about where they would be. In other words, who was going to get land over by the Jordan River? Who was going to get land over by the Mediterranean Sea? Who would get land in the desert country? Who'd get the lush hills? So on and so forth. Which tribe would bump up against which other tribe, having to live side by side? But what had not been dealt with was the size of those territories. The exact boundaries would be determined by head count, with the larger tribe getting more territory than the smaller tribes because they needed it. And as we're going to find out in the upcoming chapters, this didn't go all that smoothly. And some adjustment had to be made over the years in both size of specific tribal territories, even in their location. Now, when things are repeated in the Bible, it's because nuances are being added. Okay, more and subtle bits of information are being provided. In some cases, history is being retold so that the current and the future generations can understand the rationale that's behind certain decisions that are being made. This is the case beginning in verse 4, when yet again, We're told that Moses divided the land among the 2.5 tribes. So also so that the Levites didn't get any land inheritance, and then a reminder that the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh together represented the single tribe of Joseph. This was explained so that when the current batch of Hebrews looked back to the early tribal lists of Israel found in the Torah and saw Joseph, but no tribe of Ephraim or Manasseh, and then later saw Ephraim and Manasseh, but no tribe of Joseph, they'd understand how this transition occurred and that it was God ordained all the way. Now, let me remind you of how it was that Joseph came to be two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, neither of which went by his name. Back in Genesis 48, we get the story of the patriarch Jacob while he's living in Egypt. Now, Jacob was on the verge of death, and so he called his favorite son, who was currently the vizier of Egypt, Joseph, to his bedside. And Joseph brought his two Egyptian-born sons, literally born to Joseph's Egyptian wife, with him. They were Ephraim and Manasseh. And in a customary Hebrew blessing, done in a very uncustomary way, Jacob asked Joseph to bring those two sons forward, and then Jacob made one of those amazing and awesome prophetic pronouncements that would affect the history of God's plan of redemption right up until God's kingdom is established on earth with Yeshua at its head. In what I call the cross-handed blessing, Jacob laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, who was the younger of his two grandchildren, and he laid his left hand on the head of Manasseh. He blessed these two children, thereby making them his own sons. He made his grandchildren his own sons. Jacob literally and officially, not symbolically, literally and officially adopted Ephraim and Manasseh away from Joseph, even telling Joseph, well, any future kids you have can be yours, but these are mine. That must have staggered and upset Joseph to no end. For not only had his father Jacob taken his sons from him, but he gave the greater blessing to the second born and the lesser blessing to the firstborn. I mean, you talk about something that's upside down and backwards. By all that was customary, traditional, and right in the eyes of any Hebrew or Middle Easterner, Jacob broke all the rules. But by those same traditions, once a blessing is given, it's irreversible for any reason. So with his adoption of Ephraim and Manasseh, suddenly Jacob had 14 sons, not 12. Therefore, for a time, there were actually 14 tribes of Israel, not 12. However, before Israel left Egypt, the tribal name of Joseph was dropped and replaced with two tribes, both coming from his family, Ephraim and Manasseh. Now get the picture. The tribe of Joseph split into two, with one son, Ephraim, representing one line of Joseph, and the other son, Manasseh, representing a second line from Joseph. But removing the tribal name of Joseph now leaves us with 13 tribes of Israel. Later, out in the wilderness, God would adopt, doing just what Jacob did, God would adopt the tribe of Levi away from the nation of Jacob. The nation of Israel, we're back to 12 tribes. Levi was no longer to be counted as among his brethren, we're told. Now, while Levi's identity and heritage was certainly Hebrew, they would not be counted as a tribe of Israel any longer because they were separated out for duty as God's personal servants, his priests. They would serve Jehovah as his priests and as those who cared for his sanctuary, for the temple area. Thus, since the Levites were no longer a tribe of Israel, well, They had no right to inherit any part of the promised land. What a deal. So we find God explaining that instead of giving land as Levi's inheritance, he is Levi's inheritance. And further, as we covered one chapter back, the Lord was now going to share some of his holy property with Levi. It's a very unique privilege that would never be afforded to any of the other 12 tribes. However, the Levites had to live somewhere, so they were to be given cities within each of the 12 tribal territories, as well as some pasture land outside each city for their livestock. So we get this mysterious and quite profound lesson from what God ordained for his servants, his priests, the tribe of Levi, and it is this. First, they were to receive little to no earthly physical inheritance. Instead, theirs was to be mostly a spiritual inheritance, as not only a gift from God, but the inheritance was God. Second of all, whatever God's servants did have on this earth, it was to be given to them out of the other tribes' portions. God's priests and those sanctuary workers are to be provided for by those who are God's people and his worshipers. And third, the priests and the servants of God, the Levites, were to have as little equity, as little hold on this world as is possible for a human being. Of course, they needed clothing and homes and food and medical care, all the other basics of life that any human needs for survival. It was not meant for them to be poverty-stricken, but it was also not meant for them to be landowners or businessmen or among the more well-to-do of the community. What does this say to us in the 21st century when it is made abundantly clear in the New Testament that as disciples of Yeshua, as believers in the God of Israel, we are his new priesthood? Here are three principles that we, as God's spiritual priests, are to follow in our lifestyles as a result of our position that Jesus has won for us with his blood. This is the mindset about our position before God and in our relationship with this world that we are to adopt. We are to see our inheritance as God himself, and thus not strive to build up treasures that moth and rust doth corrupt at the cost of our relationship with the Lord's. God's ministers are to be provided for by those to whom they minister. Naturally, the level of provision varies. If there's a very small flock that requires a little of the minister's time, then it is that minister's duty to have a trade or a craft to offset at least some of his living costs. Thus, we see the priests and the Levites that do not work full-time at the temple having jobs and trades and so forth to support themselves and their families. But at the same time, God's ministers are not to seek to be provided for at a level better than the flock has at large. They are not to achieve economic advantage by becoming a servant of God. At some point, the reasonable need for receiving a decent living and thus being paid for carrying the gospel to others can turn into essentially selling the gospel for a profit. A passion and a duty can become no more than a profession. I don't need to give you examples of this. I think we can all think of them. Well, the first tribe on the west side of the Jordan to receive their inheritance was Judah. And verse 8 begins the story of just how it was that it happened this way. The camp of Israel was still located in Gilgal, and so some of the clan leaders of the tribe of Judah approached Joshua. Now specifically, it was the clan of Caleb, who sought to receive their land inheritance right now. No more waiting. So in a rather typical Middle Eastern fashion, Caleb reminds Joshua of what happened many years earlier out in the wilderness when Moses put together a scouting party of 12 to reconnoiter the land of Canaan. And Caleb and the man he's now standing before, beseeching him for land, Joshua, they were among those 12. And of course, the story was that Israel was near the area of Kadesh Barnea in the southernmost desert region of Canaan when Moses, at God's direction, decided it was time to make their move onto the land of Canaan. But the scouting party returned with bad news. They said the enemy was too well fortified. They were fierce warriors called the Anakim, who were giants, who were sure to annihilate Israel. Therefore, Israel should not attack Canaan. Now, Caleb and Joshua disagreed, not with the assessment necessarily, but with the conclusion. They agreed that the challenge was great and it was dangerous. But if God's with them, then victory is theirs. The majority won out. Israel was turned back into the desert. And what happened? They wandered around there for 38 more years. So notice in verse 6 something. It's all too easy to just read over. It says Caleb was the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite. Now, this is kind of startling when we understand what it means. Caleb's biological father was Jephunneh of the tribe of Judah, but Jephunneh died. Apparently, Caleb's mother remarried a fellow named Kenaz, hence the term Kenazites. So Kenaz became Caleb's stepfather. Kenaz was descended from Edom, a non-Israelite tribe. So here we have Caleb, who's now closely tied to the Edomites, but yet still a member of the tribe of Judah, asking for his land inheritance. Kind of complicated, isn't it? The point is, as I mentioned time after time, there is no such thing as genealogical purity among the Israelites, and there wasn't even genealogical or familial purity among the earliest Hebrews going back to Abraham. But this was exactly as God intended it. The Lord told Abraham that any foreigner who wanted to join the Hebrews was welcome, but with the understanding that to join meant to worship only the God of Abraham. Later we find out in the early development of the nation of Israel, as founded by Jacob, that most of the people that he took with him as Israelites to Egypt were actually foreigners that he had captured at Shechem. So Caleb is just another example of how race and genealogy matter little to nothing to the Lord. Instead, it's trust in him. It's faithfulness to him. That's always been the issue. It is that faith and trust that makes one part of God's people or not. Caleb reminds Joshua that Moses promised to give him the land of his choice, particularly land that Caleb had personally scouted out. Apparently, the mission Caleb was given was to reconnoiter the area of Hebron. And so that is the general area where he's asking to receive land as his clan's inheritance. Now, we get an interesting and very helpful piece of information in verse 10. It says that Caleb was 40 years old when he went with the group of 12 scouts into Canaan, and that this event occurred 45 years earlier, therefore making Caleb 85 years old. Since Israel was out of Egypt for about 2 years when they arrived at Kadesh Barnea, and the scouting party was organized, that means that at the time of this meeting between Caleb and Joshua, about 7 years had passed since Israel had arrived and crossed over the Jordan River. So all these battles that we have been reading about have taken place during an approximately 7-year time span. We also find out that the Anakim, that race of giants, they controlled the area of Hebron. So what we see happening here is that Caleb remains as bold and as confident of victory at the Lord's hand as he was 45 years earlier and a much younger man. And we don't read of anyone challenging Caleb's request for this particular place because the rest of Israel, you know what? They didn't want anything to do with those Anakim that lived around Hebron. That's okay, man. You can have Adam. In reality, Caleb asked for a whole lot more than what he wound up with. He wanted all the land, he said, that he set foot upon in Canaan. What he got was Hebron and the contiguous land. But Caleb also received a great honor. He was the very first one to receive a land inheritance inside the promised land. Number one. Now, of course, this was a reward for his steadfastness in standing with Moses and the Lord, facing down his brethren and taking a most unpopular position that Israel should ignore the strength of the enemy, proceed in faith to attack Canaan. Also notice that it was the tribe of Judah, that was Caleb's tribe, who got the first piece of land in the promised land. I want to explain something. We're going to see words in Joshua that say that the land was distributed according to the clans and the tribes. Any tribal society would understand that statement perfectly. Just as different tribes were more or less populous and more or less powerful than other ones, so were clans within a tribe that formed the tribes. Some clans, like Caleb's, had great pull and sway within their tribe. So they had a lot of influence over the politics and the daily decisions that occurred within their tribe. A tribe, you see, is just a collection of clans. That's all it is. Warfare within a tribe was between clans, clan to clan. Caleb was getting first choice of land within the tribe of Judah. This meant he was undoubtedly the most powerful clan within the tribe of Judah. Yet, as choice, it was the land, as was the very, very choice, as was the land that Caleb was asking for. It was for an unconquered land. Understand that the division of land at this point was to serve several purposes, among which was that the tribe who received a certain territory had to finish conquering it themselves. And then they had the task of maintaining control and dominance over it indefinitely. It's now theirs. It's your trouble, brother. You handle it. And this chapter ends with the words, "And the land had rest from war." This indicates a pause in the action, but we should take notice that at this point, only the smallest distribution of land had taken place. Only one clan from one tribe, Judah, had by now received any allocation of property within the land of Canaan. Even though the earlier verses spoke about Ephraim and Manasseh in the context of them not giving any of their territory to the Levites except for some cities, this did not indicate an actual land distribution yet. What we're going to find out in the upcoming chapters is that between the time of Judah being given their land inheritance and the other tribes finally getting theirs, a lull occurred. This time of little recorded activity, of a pause in the distribution of the land, came for a pretty interesting reason. Joshua couldn't find any takers for the land he was offering. The tribes fully understood that at the same time they would be settling portions of their tribal land inheritance, that's the good stuff, they also had the responsibility to drive out or kill the Canaanites who held on to certain areas within their land allotment. The not-so-good stuff. By now, Israel was essentially nomads. This generation, this is now the second generation of the Exodus, had never lived in anything but tents. They had never lived in a city. They had never planted crops. They'd never tended vineyards. They were herders. They used up pasture land, then they moved on. They knew they were comfortable with the way of the Bedouin. Taking the land, what'd that mean for them? Settling down. It meant restricting themselves to a relatively small area. It meant respecting boundaries. It meant allowing for borders. It meant defending that land. It meant battling with neighbors. Nomads move their flocks and herds away from trouble, not into it. Nomads were a non-confrontational people in general who didn't want the responsibility of villages and cities and caring for land and for crops. The last thing that interested them was war or battles for territory. So in a few chapters, we're going to find Joshua reading the Riot Act to the Israelite tribes who were just blowing off, occupying their gift of land from God. They just didn't want it. It was during this lull in land distribution that Israel moved their encampment from Gilgal, where they'd been living since the day they crossed over the Jordan, to Shiloh. We say Shiloh. Shiloh would become the new Israelite headquarters. It would be by default where the tabernacle would be erected and then all sanctuary services performed. Shiloh would be the new center of worship and government for Israel for decades. Now, if you go to Shiloh today, you can find the actual place where the wilderness tabernacle stood. I and several of you in this room have been there. You can even find the holes in the rocks where the posts were set to bear the weight of the massive curtains that surrounded the temple courts. Next week, we'll take up chapter 15, and we will watch as the land distribution effort continues.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.